Welcome to A New Prescription, where we explore modern healthcare, cutting-edge medical research and technology, and the complexities of healthcare politics. Join us as we provide insights and solutions to help you navigate the American healthcare system.
Welcome back to A New Prescription. I'm your co-host, Andrew Zwelling. And with me, of course, is Dr. Zwelling. Dad, say what's up to the people.
What's up to the people? It's great to see you, but hear you back, see you back. We have a great show today.
We do have a great show, and we have a great topic and guests. But I do first want to get to some current events. Dad, is that good with you to let's talk some current events?
There's a lot going on. Let's do it.
There's a ton going on. I first want to talk about RFK. Now, in our previous podcast, we kind of went after him a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I do have to give him kudos this week as he met with a lot of the food manufacturers about an FDA loophole labeled GRAS, which stands for generally recognized as safe. So what it has done is allowed the food companies to basically add additives to their food without really having any FDA oversight onto it. Now, I really applaud RFK's efforts to be able to stop it. Dad, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I agree. I agree on everything you just said. First off, I think his selection of this as the first thing he's going after is extremely wise. This is not really very controversial. He may annoy some people in the food industry because they may have to change a bunch of stuff if Congress passes a new law. But I doubt anybody in the general public is going to take any offense whatever to getting additives out of our food and making our food safer. And that's after all what Mr. Kennedy said he was going to do. He was going to make America healthy again. Well, this is a real step in the right direction. I have to give him credit for that. I agree.
And yeah, I just think there's so much processed crap in our food making people really sick. I mean, is there a link between what's put in our food from an additive standpoint to long-term chronic diseases like cancer?
I don't know. And I'm not sure anybody knows. You'd have to really dissect what's in these foods. And there is a ton. All you have to do is read any label on any popular junk food. And you will see what's in there, most of which you don't understand, something Jackie Mason made fun of 30 years ago. You know, what's in there? Nobody knows. I think that's exactly right. And I think if we can develop a system where we first know what's in the food, secondly, know the effect of the stuff that's in the food, and then get the garbage out of our food, it'll help. I mean, the real problem with junk food more than anything else is calories, but that's another matter.
But talking about being able to regulate these additives, one of my concerns is, I applaud RFK for doing this, but he's going to need personnel, scientists, toxicologists to be able to review what's going on into our food. And now DOGE is cutting out all these people. Are there concerns that they are undercutting RFK by eliminating people from the government that can do this work?
I think that every secretary in the cabinet, and Marco Rubio made this pretty clear at a cabinet meeting really recently, are very upset at Musk cutting their department without any input from them. And personally, I think, without any really examination of what these people do. I've already had one go around with the IRS where they sent me a letter requiring a phone call. It took me, I think, 10 or 11 times just to get on a line. It was then another 30 minutes before a human came to the line. But that was the first time in 11 tries I even got through. And my guess is that's happening all over the government.
And what's happening with Rubio? I mean, do you see that playing out as happening between RFK and Musk?
Not yet is the best way to answer that question. Do I think if he starts cutting people at the FDA and the CDC who do vital work on which Mr. Kennedy is going to depend to get his work done, I think he's going to be very annoyed. Yes.
So I want to transition more to what's going on this week, and it's everywhere about the tariffs. And we're not a financial podcast. We're not talking about the implications of tariffs, other than what are the implications on the healthcare system, and then if it in turn does get us into a recession, what are the impacts of a recession on our healthcare delivery in this country?
Okay, the healthcare system is not disconnected from the economy. It's a significant part of the economy. So if there is anything that threatens the economy, and there's, let's say, inflation gets out of control, or we have a true recession, the amount of money people have to spend on anything is going to be limited. That includes doctor visits, that includes insurance premiums, that includes pharmaceuticals. So any threat to the economy where people will have less money in their pockets is a threat to their healthcare. They are intertwined. They cannot be separated.
But I could also imagine that the prescription drugs come from out of this country. The generic come from out of this country. Those are going to be more expensive. And then in turn, the premiums are going to be driven up because to pay for everything, right?
Yes, that's exactly, I think that's what I said. There is a problem throughout the healthcare system when there's a problem in the economy. And it refers to paying doctors, paying insurance premiums, and paying for pharmaceuticals. You're absolutely right. A huge amount of the generic drugs in the country, and people take about 80% or so of the drugs people take are generic in this country. That's going to increase the price of them as well. You're absolutely right.
So the price could go up. We could become less healthy. And I'm not just talking about from a mental health standpoint, which is one aspect of a recession, but it's actually going to physically impede the growth of the healthcare industry to take care of patients.
Yes, I think that when the economy is in trouble, patients are in trouble, the healthcare system is in trouble. And by the way, the economy affects physicians as well. So it affects everybody. And the thought that these tariffs are going to solve any of our problems, and it's very unclear to me. And I do believe that history says that tariffs are an unwise way for us to right any problem that we have. It goes back to Smoot-Hawley in the early 30s, which extended the Depression. President Reagan railed against tariffs.
Yeah, I mean, I sent you a video of President Reagan basically saying, it seems at first it could be the patriotic thing to do, but what it basically causes is government subsidy, and we're not going to be very competitive in the market because we're not competing against international markets. So it's, to me, it's very anti-American to impose tariffs because it's not a free market.
There's a mindset here on the part of President Trump that America, for some reason, is not part of the rest of the world. But America is intertwined with the rest of the world. It's a globalized world. Just any car goes across, any assembly of a car goes across the border of Mexico and Canada many times. There is no question that these tariffs will increase the price of a car. That makes no sense. That's also true with pharmaceuticals. They're coming in from all over the world. If he places tariffs on every pharmaceutical that comes across the border, the price of drugs is going to explode. It already is too high.
Yeah, and I think I'm most concerned also with the inconsistency of the on again, off again. Uncertainty is actually even worse than higher prices for companies. If they cannot plan for what's going to happen in the next 6 months, it's very unsettling to these companies, right?
Actually, it's more like 5 years. The CEO has to have a 5 or 10 year time horizon. This, one of the first things we were taught in business school is the markets hate uncertainty. We are seeing that now. You've seen it. You're absolutely right. It's the blog I'm in the middle of writing, even as we speak, titled Uncertainty. No industry, no government, no store, even just a single store, can deal with uncertainty. Or they will for sure have to raise prices, and prices will undoubtedly be passed on to customers. That's true in healthcare. That's true in any industry.
And I do understand some of Trump's sentiment in that we have not great deals with countries. Our trade deficit isn't great. We're getting tariffed on things in other countries that are not reciprocal. I completely do see that viewpoint, but I think going about it this way is not the way to solve that problem. But, you know, I'm not president.
Well, I mean, my understanding is he changed the agreement between Mexico and Canada before. If he feels there are other, like with China, if he feels that we are in an unfair position, that's a cause for negotiation. It's not a cause to start a trade war, which is what he's done. There's a certain bit of arrogance to all this and American exceptionalism to all of this that I think doesn't benefit the country. I think he is doing things that he may think are right, but I think are not going to be good for the country long-term. His five-year time horizon is poor. He has about a five-minute time horizon, as far as I can tell, and it changes his mind all the time. This is not good for a leader. A leader can certainly change his or her mind. There's nothing wrong with being wrong and saying so. But you cannot be so peripatetic as to one minute think you're going to have a tariff and next minute you're going to take it off. That's just no way to lead. It's not effective.
So let's get to our main topic tonight. Last week, we talked about drug intervention as it helps with obesity, cardiac disease, and even preventing cancer. But there were two other parts of that equation that we discussed on briefly. One is of nutrition, and that's what you eat. And then two is our topic today, exercise. And exercise is more than just a way to lose weight or get control of cardiovascular disease, but can also be an integral part in the treatment of cancer. It can also be a very important part in helping with the recovery of any invasive surgeries or very heavy treatments that patients have to go through when they have cancer. And with us today to talk all about exercise is Dr. Savannah Rotchendorfer, who received a BS in biology from Indiana University, her MS in clinical exercise physiology from the University of Miami, and a PhD in exercise physiology from the University of Texas here in Austin, Texas. She's currently the director of the Clinical Exercise Oncology Laboratory at Baylor University. Savannah, we are so excited to have you on the show. Welcome to A New Prescription Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Nice to see you again. You know, where I want to start today is, how did you first become interested in studying exercise and cancer care?
Yeah, interestingly enough, it started during my education, during my PhD at the University of Texas in Austin. I got involved in a project very early on, which utilized exercise in an abdominal cancer patient population. And it wasn't until I saw the magnitude of the impact of that study that I truly thought to myself, this is what I want my career to be based on. And it changed me intrinsically because of that.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. What was the impact?
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially what I did during my dissertation was I utilized a prehabilitation program. So you can think of it as an exercise and nutrition intervention in these abdominal cancer patients who were undergoing surgery. And so what we did was we utilized 4 weeks of a program, and we basically saw tremendous impact on not only their physical function and their increase in musculoskeletal function and their variables for those outcomes, but we saw that clinically after surgery, they had significant reductions in their hospital length of stay. And on average, they returned back to activities of daily living faster than individuals who didn't undergo that specific type of exercise intervention. And so, I not only saw, let's say, the physiological benefit, but the overall attitude of the cancer patient that underwent this program was monumental. It almost gave them this sense of control over their health in a circumstance that was very uncontrollable, right? And so what's exciting is seeing these patients feel like they regain a sense of control over their health.
We'll return to the issue of whether exercise has a role in controlling the incidence of cancer, but let's start with a definition of prehabilitation and whether or not that had any effect on survival in this group of patients, if that's known.
Yeah, absolutely. So prehabilitation is essentially initially developed with physical exercise as the primary intervention to optimally improve a patient's frailty and functional capacity prior to a surgery. And this is by targeting cardiovascular or musculoskeletal adaptations and improvements, right? And so by triggering these improvements, you ultimately can improve the body's ability to withstand a surgical stress.
So that's more, it's exercise specifically before some sort of surgical or chemotherapy intervention.
Exactly.
And what about its effect long-term on these patients? Is there any data?
So for the study that we did, we didn't follow long-term. However, we did follow up to 90 days after the surgery for these patients. And so what we did see was an improvement in overall quality of life. And that was extremely important in addition to the clinical outcomes that I'd already mentioned. But I think what we will see as you know research continues and when you continue to follow these patients in the populations for longer terms is that individuals who do undergo a prehabilitation program typically are set up for better success, let's say, health-wise.
So what people commonly think of with exercise and the body is reduction or prevention of obesity. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's true. But how does that compare to the very popular new GLP-1 drugs about which we spoke in a previous podcast? Are they better? Is exercise better? GLP drugs better? Or is it better when you combine them?
Yeah, you know, actually, I recently read a study which combined both, you know, GLP-1 drugs and exercise. And it was actually the group who did both GLP-1 and exercise saw the greatest reduction in abdominal adiposity and their metabolic syndrome severity score. So there is a place, I think, for both GLP-1 and exercise to be combined for a better outcome. But I would like to also simultaneously plug that we know that GLP-1 alone could be potentially deleterious to skeletal muscle, right? It can cause skeletal muscle loss. And so I think a big part of the conversation and education in when you involve patients who are receiving GLP-1 is really to emphasize the importance of exercise alongside the drug, right? To maintain your skeletal muscle and make sure that you're keeping those harmful effects that or side effects that are unwanted away when you are, actively taking something, which is ultimately changing your overall, body composition.
So does the use of exercise and or GLP-1 drugs have an effect on the incidence of cancer? In other words, is this a prevention strategy?
Yeah, I think there's actually a large popular, focus on this right now is that this potentially could be a means to prevent cancer, right? With this idea of chronic low-grade inflammation that's associated with obesity, we want to start to have the conversation of how do we combat that low-grade, inflammation that's chronic, which ultimately may lead to cancer development. And it's drugs like GLP-1, which may be a great way to potentially start to look at long-term clinical trials or studies, which does ultimately lead to the potential prevention of cancer as well as exercise, right? So if the goal is to target obesity, I think GLP-1 and exercise have a positive, let's say, hopeful future in that field.
So the connection is obesity, inflammation, cancer, and you are targeting the first step with GLP-1 drugs and exercise, if possible. Do I have that right?
That's correct, right? So if one of the hypotheses, right, is this low-grade inflammation that's caused through obesity, right, it's important to kind of target that mechanism specifically.
Are there any data on how the reduction in obesity is connected to inflammation? How does obesity lead to inflammation, which is obviously could be a key point, not only in cancer, but other diseases?
Absolutely. So essentially, this low-grade inflammation can cause significant genomic instability or metabolic changes, as well as immune suppression. And this ultimately is what can contribute to cancer development or progression. And so, oftentimes, There is an important, let's say, anti-inflammatory response when it comes to the utilization of exercise, which can actually combat this chronic low-grade inflammation, which is kind of why I love what I do, right? And I really emphasize the importance of exercise because of this.
Well, what about the fact, the question I guess I have is, what about the cancer treatments? We always hear about them as being stirring up inflammatory things and doing damage to other organs. Is there any effect of exercise on that? Is the mechanism by which those things damage normal tissues known? And is that mechanism one that exercise and even GLP-1 drugs could affect?
Yeah, so cancer treatments like chemotherapy or radiation can cause damage to healthy tissues through a variety of mechanisms. Some of them include reactive oxygen species and inflammation. Cancer treatments can cause DNA and mitochondrial damage. They can cause direct cellular death. In the case of skeletal muscle, it's often a downregulation of protein synthesis and an upregulation of protein degradation. But when it comes to specifically exercise and how it kind of targets some of those pathways, it's important to consider that essentially exercise is key to kind of preventing this downregulation of protein synthesis, right? So it promotes, let's say healthy tissue regulation. And so it's this protective effect of exercise that number one, not only depends on, let's say the frequency and the intensity and the type, but also the response can also depend on additional factors like age, or we've seen differences in cancer types or treatment types and sex. So there is a lot of research still to be done on how exercise protects in these particular, dependent areas and factors like age, cancer type, and treatment.
And the organs most susceptible to chemotherapy damage that exercise could help? Which are they?
Yes. So specifically the ones that I focus on in my research is the heart, right? I mean, ultimately there's a lot of different toxicities that occur systemically to vital organs, but I particularly work with obviously the skeletal muscle, and I look at the central vascular system. And so obviously we know that exercise is great for your heart, especially aerobic exercise. So it can combat some of these detrimental effects that chemotherapy can have on the development potentially of cardiotoxicity.
So exercise can, in fact, prevent the damage or stop the damage produced by the chemotherapy drugs to the heart?
Yes. Yeah, so there are a lot of very early studies that are out that have been done with animal studies showing the promise of exercise to prevent cardiotoxicity. There is still a lot of clinical trials to be conducted that will hopefully show irrefutable evidence that exercise does indeed prevent cardiotoxicity. But there's a lot of, juries still out on the irrefutable evidence. And so it's a part of my job to continue this work to show that indeed, the clinical studies in the patient populations match up to the promise that we're seeing in the animal studies.
And these exercise programs are people now, not mice. What are they? What do? Do you get them on treadmills or what do you do?
Yeah, so the general recommendation, which is from the American College of Sports Medicine, is about 30 minutes of moderate intensity exercise. They recommend 3 days a week, and it's combined aerobic and resistance training. So that could be walking, that could be, like you said, treadmill, it could be cycling, it could be swimming. And then, of course, when I say resistance training, I mean, basically weightlifting, right? And so a lot of the exercises that are prescribed are at the discretion of the patient, meaning it should be on a prescription base of what that patient likes to engage in, what they're likely to continue with on their own, and is sustainable for them.
But there must be some challenges with some of these patients who aren't able to do the exercise. Is there a way to get around it, or are there other exercises, maybe in a swimming pool? Is there something they can do?
Of course. So there's one of the biggest you know, challenges, I think, in exercise physiology is that behavioral change and being challenged with populations that are having some difficulties with navigating traditional exercise training, right? When we consider the high intensity and potentially the frail state of a cancer patient or their overall fatigue or energy levels due to their chemotherapy, it's important to consider alternatives that are, you know, kind of amenable to some of their lower energy levels. And so one of the things that I've done in my research with prehab is I've utilized blood flow restriction training. And so blood flow restriction training essentially accounts for both, let's say, and the frailty of the cancer patient population.
Okay,
but
let's
still
go there. What is it? What is blood flow restriction at all?
Absolutely. So blood flow restriction training is an exercise modality, which basically works by placing blood flow restriction cuffs or bands, which is essentially just like a blood pressure cuff, on the proximal portions of your arms and your legs. And then it's pressurized to occlude or restrict, venous return to the heart while still maintaining arterial inflow to the working muscle. So it creates this muscle ischemia, essentially. So it produces metabolic stress that is very, very important when it comes to receiving some of those resistant exercise training benefits, right? So they create these adaptations of hypertrophy through metabolic accumulation of growth hormone or IGF-1. They also increase skeletal muscle fiber activation and recruitment. And in general, it's important to the mechanism of increased muscle protein synthesis. This is all very, very unique in the sense that you can get all of these adaptations by working at significantly less of your traditional resistance training regimen.
But this is not something you do on your own, I take it. You need a guide through how much pressure.
I've ordered the bands already. So I've got them ready to go. I'm really excited about using them. I mean, I'll have to get back to it. I assume you do need some guidance, but I bought my bands from Be Strong. There's other bands out there that people use, but that just seemed to have the best reviews from what I see. I don't know, Savannah, maybe you can talk more about the Olympians who use it. Can this be done in or the regular exercise aficionado, not just people with cancer? It'd be good to hear about that piece as well.
Yeah, so traditionally BFR was used as a means of rehabilitation in an injured patient population, right? So I like to think that this is an extremely accessible modality of not only training and increasing muscle hypertrophy, but also for rehabilitation. So you'll find studies out there that BFR has been used in frail, injured, or older populations for exactly these purposes. And on top of that, they're used in our Olympic athletes. And a big portion of this, which maybe Andrew has read, is, you know, the use of them in the New York Times and through celebrities and things like this. And it really is just giving that little competitive edge to increase muscle hypertrophy while also simultaneously consider some of the rehab benefits of it. And it's extremely accessible in the sense of it's meant for everyone to be able to basically watch an educational video and then perform at home on their own.
Okay. So YouTube's you need guidance.
Well, YouTube's great for that, Dad. We have YouTube these days.
Yeah. Even I've learned to use YouTube, believe it or not. I use it to fix things or open things I don't know how to do, but it's pretty good for that.
There you go.
A little bit more on the BFR training. Why did you specifically, or when did you specifically see that training as good for these cancer patients that are recovering from these very heavy treatments and their very heavy surgeries?
Yeah, so I actually was introduced to BFR by a master's student that was going through my program simultaneously, and he was kind of pivotal in educating me in BFR. And one of the things that we had to consider are the challenges, the hurdles that we were presented with when working with these physicians who had cancer patients that had undergone their chemotherapies and were in a short window of time prior to their surgical, let's say, schedule, was that the patient was really frail. And general exercise physiology training will tell you that you need a minimum of 6 weeks and you need to work at about 80 to 85% of your one repetition max. Well, we didn't have 6 weeks because the average time we typically have was about 4 weeks prior to their surgery. And we were working with an older, frail GI patient population. And so how do we really start to address both of those concerns? It was the education on BFR that really changed the game for us. And it was that BFR allows these very fast adaptations to skeletal muscle. So, and as little as 2 weeks, but we utilized 4 weeks. And it accommodates that frailty, right? So you can work at low as 20% of your one repetition max rather than 80 to 85%, which is what traditionally is required. And so because it kind of touched on both of these key, let's say, hurdles we had to attack, we thought that this was the best modality. And we kind of looked to this field of, you know, sports performance and sports medicine for the answer.
Excellent.
I have a kind of a dumb question, but I assume the answer is yes. This can be applied to anybody that's about to go through any surgery, or even maybe women who are going through pregnancy, right?
100%. So there are some contraindications and risks that you always need to make sure that you check in with. Like deep vein thrombosis is one of the kind of precursors that you should not use blood flow restriction training. So I do have to advocate for that. And of course, just general clearance from your physician that you are okay to engage in exercise. But BFR training in a healthy person or a patient population has basically been shown to present no greater risk than traditional exercise. So I think that's really important. The other thing is that, yes, I absolutely would advocate and hope for in the future that BFR is used more regularly as a prehab to individuals who are relatively frail that are undergoing a surgical procedure and maybe higher risk for poor surgical outcomes, right? So we're able to build up those physiological reserves in a relatively short time period, but still ultimately keeping the patient safe and getting the benefit of a quicker recovery on the back end.
The obvious question is, why aren't more doctors doing this? And of course, the corollary is, what about insurance paying for it?
Yeah, these two are my favorite questions of all. So when it comes to doctors, I think in my experience, I can't speak for everyone. In my experience, it is that the physicians are paying attention to the primary reason that they are seeing that patient, and as they should. I will say that again, as they should. However, there has been a shift in recent years to pay more attention in the area of prevention and improvement of patient outcomes and prevention of treatment-related toxicities and those types of things. And because of that, they're now starting to pivot into what can they advise the patient to do as a preventative mechanism. And I think exercise is getting more attention because of that, which is really amazing. And there's a lot more in the field to do. However, on the flip side of that coin is their organizational readiness, right? I'm talking about the stakeholders that are within the hospital systems and the clinics that need to be communicated to on a regular basis of the value of exercise, right? And informing their leadership, having internal advocates and champions for clinical education on how exercise is beneficial. Those are still major hurdles that we're looking at, but hoping to overcome in the next several years and well into the future. On the side of insurance, no, this is not covered. So everything that I have done has been a part of a clinical research study of some nature. I think one of the biggest, pivots to get insurance involved potentially is really looking into some of these, accrediting programs that govern patient care. Right. So they kind of set the structure or the standard of care for these patients that come through certain, with diagnosis in the cancer, in the case of cancer, for example, the patient will be seen. And then importantly, this individual will undergo an additional variety of screenings, whether it's a nutrition screening or they'll give access to all these other things that are important to overall substantial patient care. Exercise isn't a part of that conversation yet. It's not required as a part of that supportive patient cancer care. And so I think it's important that these governing bodies also start to have these recommendations within their overall blueprint so that it can be covered by insurance.
One of the things this podcast is focused on is having patients be better educated so they can get better outcomes. Patients should be asking for exercise programs, I guess. And if there's an obesity factor in this, the GLP-1 drugs are another thing patients might be asking for. But let's focus on the exercise for a moment. What should a patient articulate to the doctor if that patient wants to participate in an exercise program? What should they say?
Absolutely. I think you are your biggest health advocate. And I think alongside any type of prescription drug that is being given, a patient, especially in the case of obesity or any cardiovascular risk factor, should also ask about programs that are available either through the hospital system or within their community that contain exercise and that help them modify their overall lifestyle behaviors when it comes to both exercise and diet, right? So asking your physician, what are my resources? And if they don't know what the resources are, thank God for our age of technology, where a lot of programs are accessible online, especially the American College of Sports Medicine is one of the websites that I always say is an incredible resource for you to just get the basic layout of what should exercise look like on a weekly basis for me or someone who is high risk for cardiovascular disease, right?
And so repeat that website again.
Yeah, so it's the American College of Sports Medicine, and it's our, let's say, national standard that's set out there for American guidelines for individuals who are wanting to stay healthy and fit and have a great health span.
When a patient gets into the healthcare system, could a physical therapy consult get them what they need?
Absolutely. But I think one of the, let's say, hurdles is that a physical therapy consult only happens when the physician deems that it's necessary, right? So a lot of times, if there is no real causal need for some type of physical rehabilitation, and a lot of times they'll just deem it as, I'll figure it out on my own. So physical therapy has a lot of great, let's say, potential to be the first avenue of patient education, 100%. I think it's the hurdle of getting them in there and optimally one day covered by insurance that they have that initial recommendation to go off of.
There's a matter of educating the healthcare system in the benefits of exercise, both obviously to prevent obesity, probably to prevent cancer, and certainly in cancer patients to get them ready for chemotherapy and surgery as well. All of that is a benefit of exercise that patients should seek out whether they have cancer or not, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, exercise is extremely beneficial for many, many reasons. But in regard to these specific populations, I'm a huge advocate for exercise being a core part of their patient care.
How do we get there? What do you think we need to do to get there to make that actually happen?
Yeah, I mean, I think number one, it's reminding the Western society, the importance of exercise. And I think it's that educational piece, right? I think a lot of times we learn as kids, exercise is good for you, but we forget what that means. And so how do we get back to the basics of educating those around us, right? Exercise is crucial for your overall health management, your well-being, your weight management, your physiological function, prevention of chronic disease. I think it's the American Heart Association that estimates up to 90% of cardiovascular disease is preventable with education and action, right? And so understanding that we have the power to take back some of our health control and put it into our hands through modifiable risk factors, like engaging in exercise, is really powerful. And I think reminding not only just the average American, but also all of those in the care system, the possibility of better patient care and advocating for your patient by encouraging exercise and getting it intricately involved into your system has a lot of payoff, right? Not just for the patient itself, but even if you want to consider the insurance side of things, right? You potentially have the ability to save money on the payout if your patient is healthier coming into some of their treatments.
Yeah, so I think we've talked about why exercise is so great as both a preventive form of medicine, a prehabilitation. There's some very specific exercises and blood flow restriction training that can really help target and help these patients. You also talked about there needs to be a push on the accredited treatment institution and bodies to try to get exercise as part of the curriculum so that insurance can cover. Is there anything else that you'd like to cover with us? This is absolutely fascinating. It's one of my favorite topics because I'm a huge advocate of exercise. Are there any last words you have for us?
I would just say that reminding everyone that you know and you love how important exercise is, and not just because of that good old saying that it's good for you and you get some fresh air, but it really is, you know, pivotal for your health span, not just for the cancer patient, not just for someone who is obese, but generally for every individual. You know, exercise has tremendous benefit, and I really look forward to where the field is going, especially in exercise oncology. And I really hope to be back on here to tell you about all the new pivotal discoveries that kind of come up over the next couple of years.
Thank you so much for joining A New Prescription. We're so excited that you stopped by. Please join us on our social pages at A New Prescription, and also subscribe to our YouTube channel at A New Prescription YouTube. Remember, your health is the most important thing to you. We'll see you next time.